Hey fam, I'm Simone Boyce.
I'm Danielle Robay.
And we're the hosts of The Bright Side, the podcast from Hello Sunshine that's guaranteed to light up your day.
Check out our recent episode with dancer, actress, and host of Dancing with the Stars, Julianne Hough, revealing the healing journey behind her new novel, Everything We Never Knew.
I am showing up for my younger self, and it is becoming a ripple effect energetically in my life, and that's why I feel so safe now.
Listen to The Bright Side from Hello Sunshine on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jacquees Thomas, the host of a brand new Black Effect original series, Black Lit, the podcast for diving deep into the rich world of Black literature. Black Lit is for the page turners, for those who listen to audiobooks while running errands or at the end of a busy day. From thought-provoking novels to powerful poetry, we'll explore the stories that shape our culture. Listen to Black Lit on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect Podcast Network is sponsored by Diet Coke.
There's so much beauty in Mexican culture, like mariachis, delicious cuisine, and even lucha libre. Join us for the new podcast, Lucha Libre Behind the Mask, a 12-episode podcast in both English and Spanish about the history and cultural richness of lucha libre. And I'm your host, Santos Escobar, Emperor of Lucha Libre and a WWE superstar. Listen to Lucha Libre Behind the Mask on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you stream podcasts.
Back in the 90s, the crime and murder rate in Philadelphia was at its peak. There were more than 500 murders in 1990, and the rate remained above 400 through 1997. A lot of this crime happened in North Philadelphia, in areas notorious for sex work and where open-air drug markets thrived. I've reported on and spoken to people who lived and grew up in the area for years. People who've been punished by a system hell-bent on jailing its way out of social problems like poverty, addiction, and mental health. Most of these people were young men and boys of color, considered, quote, super predators by politicians of the time, like Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden.
They are not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy.
Without parents, without supervision, without any structure, without any conscience developing.
One of those boys was David Luis Suave Gonzalez. Suave grew up in prison, but he was given a chance to prove he was more than the mistake that landed him behind bars. While doing time, Suave earned degrees and created enrichment programs aimed at things like helping men behind bars with kids become better fathers. Throughout his years of mentorship, Suave met a young man named Eddie Ramirez, also from North Philadelphia.
I remember when he came to the prison, he came looking for me because he had heard of me in another prison. I took him under the wing and, you know, I became his mentor and he became my little brother.
Suave told me that during the decades he'd spent in prison meeting people from all walks of life, Eddie Ramirez stuck out.
He started talking to me about, I'm innocent. And I was like, okay, everybody in prison is innocent, you know, because that's something we don't discuss in the prison system. But what I noticed was that Eddie really lived like an innocent person in prison. And he only told me one time. He never ran around saying to me, convincing me or nothing. He just said, I'm innocent, but I got to do what I got to do to survive in here and to get out.
Before life in prison, Eddie was a hyper little kid, doing the things kids in cities do.
I just wanted to just be happy. I just wanted to have a comfortable life, celebrating it with family and friends.
What would that look like?
At the time, it probably would have been like smoking weed, watching rap videos, skateboarding.
Yeah.
Like that. And I'm trying to think how much of that has changed in the last 30 years.
Eddie was fortunate, unlike Suave. He grew up in a stable home with both parents, siblings, and love. In fact, Eddie's father was a police officer with the Philadelphia Police, and Eddie grew up respecting the law.
I just never thought of the police as being corrupt.
Do you think they were corrupt in your case?
I mean, I ended up in prison for something I didn't do.
From Lava for Good, this is Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling.
My name is Eddie Ramirez, and I was in prison for 27 and a half years for something I didn't do.
Today, Eddie Ramirez. Eddie was born on November 10th, 1976, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He's one of three kids.
I have two older sisters who were both my protectors and my bullies, and I love them.
What was it like being the little brother to two older sisters?
Do you have any younger siblings?
I do.
You should ask them, see what they say about that.
So he said you guys were his protectors, but also his bullies. What does he mean by that?
Well, he'll have to actually clear which one was the actual bully. I'm not going to say anything other than that.
This is Emily, Eddie's sister.
He's 5 years younger than me. So imagine, I was 5 years old when this little baby boy comes to the world, and my sister's only like a year and a half older than me. So he was just, you know, the little boy of the house.
I was the pesky little brother, but at the same time, they adored me.
Emily says she did and does adore Eddie and remembers him as an active kid, always getting into everything.
Kid Eddie was a lot of imagination. He was just always active the way he is now, always active, always trying to do something. At home, we have this the saying, only us, the Ramirez's, know that we say to each other, we fick it, because he used to say every time he would go underneath the table and make pretend he's fixing something, and then he'll tell Mama, I fick it, I fick it. So all of us now, whenever we fix something, we just say, we fick it.
We did have a driveway behind my house where the kids from 9th Street and the kids from Hutchinson Street gathered to play sports, freeze tag.
Football, baseball, king. We did everything. So the majority of the people were our age, my sister and I. I think Eddie might have been the youngest of them all. So, and there was a couple of older guys. So, yeah, Eddie was so hyper that, you know, people didn't want, you know, they didn't want him to be around. So we would have to come to his defense. I know one time I fought a little boy because he did something to Eddie. And Eddie was crying, and I went out and I fought him. I still get called the mean girl because of that. I'm the mean sister because of that.
Although Eddie grew up with older sisters, he still found boy time.
My cousins were the closest thing I had to brothers, and I did everything with them. We played Street Fighter. We played Nintendo. We would go to Hunting Park, play football or basketball. We went shopping. We chased girls, everything that you could think about. I did everything with my family. In fact, I like to tell people I didn't have friends. My friends were family members.
Mm. Tell me about growing up in Philly back then. You said North Philly?
It depends on what you define as North Philly. Okay. It is technically North Philly, but people from North Philly might not think of my neighborhood as being North Philly. I'm Logan, north of the Boulevard.
Okay.
There were trees on my block. Like, maybe our experience isn't typical of the North Philly experience, but all of my cousins graduated from college or went to the military, have stable lives. None of them ever been arrested for anything. While there were drugs in my neighborhood, it probably wasn't as visible as some of the other neighborhoods throughout North Philly. My upbringing was pretty modest, pretty working class family. I never knew poverty. I never wanted for anything.
This sounds very different from a lot of stories I've heard from North Philly at the time. So were you ever involved in any kind of crime, drugs, anything like that?
No, I mean, I was a graffiti writer as a kid. Uh-huh. So, you know, that.
No robberies, no guns.
No. In fact, being the son of a police officer, I've never even seen a gun.
As I mentioned, Eddie's father was a Philadelphia police officer.
I sort of like idolized the police because I actually saw them as heroes. Because not only was my father a police officer, I have several uncles who were sheriffs and prison guards. I grew up in a law enforcement family.
Wow. Our upbringing was nothing but police officers. I mean, we used to go camping, and it used to be all my father's buddies.
Oh my God. Like, we used to go camping in Coatesville in the summertime every weekend. And so I grew up with all those families. They were all like cousins to me.
February 19th, 1995 was like any day for 18-year-old Eddie Ramirez. He was looking to have fun and hang out with friends. Eddie's dad gave him permission to spend the night at his friend Mary Emanuel's house. His friend, 18-year-old William Billy Wyhee, was there, and Pete Gozy.
Well, Pete, I didn't know that well at all.
Okay.
Pete was Billy's friend.
Okay.
Billy was someone who I'd met in years prior to that, not many years. I didn't, where I would have said I loved Billy like a brother. The truth of the matter is, I didn't know Billy that well. Apparently, I didn't know him that well. And I think that it was obvious to everybody that him and I did not complement each other.
What does that mean?
We were into different things. Like, I'm a big dreamer. I don't know what he's into, but it wasn't that. It's you know, now thinking about it, I'm like, man, I didn't know that guy at all.
But Billy wound up playing a key role in Eddie's case, and you'll be hearing more about him later. Back to that winter day in 1995. So they're all hanging out at Mary Emanuel's house, and at around 11 p.m., Eddie heads out to the laundromat across the street to get a soda for Mary's dad, Jay Darnell Sr. He asked for the soda earlier in the night, but the kids forgot, so Mary sent Eddie. According to Eddie and his attorneys, he was at the laundromat for 15 to 30 minutes. He says he met a girl there and started flirting. She was one of the last customers of the night. They exchanged numbers, and Eddie headed back. Around 1 a.m., he actually called the girl, and they spoke for a few minutes. And shortly after, Jay Darnell asked everyone to leave. Peter Gozy gave Eddie and Billy Wyhee a ride back to Billy's house. And that was that. The end of a mostly uneventful night. The next day, on February 20th, police found the body of a woman bludgeoned to death in the laundromat. Joyce Dennis was an employee there. She was a mother and a newlywed. And it was her first shift back from her honeymoon in Mexico. When Joyce didn't come home after her shift at 2 a.m., her husband, Jim, went to look for her.
She would close up the laundromat late at night, and she hadn't come home and hadn't called. So he went to the laundromat, and when he went inside, he saw blood. And he flagged down a cop who arrived at the scene, and they investigated and discovered the victim's body, and she was beaten to death, basically.
This is Michael Wiseman.
I'm a lawyer in Pennsylvania. I work in a small firm called Wiseman & Schwartz.
Michael says Joyce had been hit in the head at least 9 times with a metal bar the police had found at the scene. When they arrived, there was blood everywhere, and the door handles, inside deadbolts, all on the floor. They found a fleece with blood on it, and the place also appeared to have been robbed. While investigating, the police talked to Jay Darnell a few days after the killing.
The dad of this girl who wanted the soda reported to the police that, oh, Eddie went to the laundromat to get a soda, and that's it. They were off to the races. Eddie's the suspect.
Police start asking about Eddie.
The cops got all these, you know, 15, 16, 17-year-olds, you know, in the station, or as they used to call it, the roundhouse. And basically, 6 or so people who gave statements against Eddie.
What follows is a months-long investigation in which a story starts to develop about Eddie and a party and a confession. A story that unfolds like a game of telephone. A key part of the story comes from a known drug dealer named Corey Watkins. Police interview Watkins, and he tells them a 17-year-old kid named Joseph Mayo told him that Billy Wyhee had killed a woman at the laundromat. Remember, Billy was Eddie's friend, the one he was with that night. Watkins does not mention anything about Eddie. Police also bring in Billy Wyhee for questioning. And Billy ends up telling police that Eddie killed Joyce Dennis during a robbery while he stood lookout. And after, he and Eddie went to a friend's party to buy drugs. 15-year-old Luis Rivera says he was at that party, and he tells police that Billy told him he and Eddie, quote, went to do a stick-up and Eddie hurt the lady and that the lady died. Watkins' girlfriend, Melanie Foreman, also a local drug dealer, tells police she saw Eddie a few days later, and he confessed to her. The police eventually re-interview Mayo, who, remember, hadn't said anything about Eddie originally. But now he says Billy and Eddie told him they were involved in the death of Joyce Dennis at the laundromat. Almost a year and a half after Joyce Dennis was found bludgeoned to death, Billy Wyhee was arrested. The following day, on the 4th of July, Eddie was working the overnight attendant shift at a gas station when police showed up and arrested him.
And I thought, okay, clearly they made a mistake and cooler heads will prevail. Let me do what I can so I can get back to work.
But that's not what happened.
I stayed in jail for 20 months awaiting trial.
Both were charged with murder, robbery, and criminal conspiracy. Billy took a deal pleading to a lesser sentence in exchange for testifying as the star witness against Eddie at trial. What followed for Eddie's family was mostly confusion.
We remember that day when we were told he was arrested. I immediately went over to my sister's house and we were just like in shock and what were we going to do? And we didn't even know what to do. We did not know what to do. It was embarrassing in the beginning. Family didn't want to talk about it. And, you know, everybody thinks that if you go to jail, you have something to do with it. Nobody is going to believe, oh, they're innocent. My brother's innocent. He had nothing to do with it, like nothing. You know, nobody believed that. Nobody believed it. There was always doubt in people's minds.
Emily says her dad was desperate. And being a former cop, he started to look into the case, too, to see if anything implicated Eddie.
My dad checked the house, I think, 1,000 times. He tried to investigate the case. He tried to be detective and found nothing. And it was just mind-boggling.
What person says, hey, let me prepare for a rainy day in the case I get arrested for something I didn't do? So you don't, no, that's not something you prepare for. It's just something you're in the moment. And when the moment comes, for some people, catches you off guard.
And nothing could have prepared him for what came next.
When you think of Mexican culture, you think of avocado, mariachi, delicious cuisine, and of course, lucha libre. It doesn't get more Mexican than this. Lucha Libre is known globally because it is much more than just a sport and much more than just entertainment. Lucha Libre is a type of storytelling. It's a dance. It's tradition. It's culture. This is Lucha Libre Behind the Mask, a 12-episode podcast in both English and Spanish about the history and cultural richness of Lucha Libre. And I'm your host, Santos Escobar, the emperor of Lucha Libre and a WWE superstar. Santos! Join me as we learn more about the history behind this spectacular sport from its inception in the United States to how it became a global symbol of Mexican culture. We'll learn more about some of the most iconic heroes in the ring. This is Lucha Libre Behind the Mask. Listen to Lucha Libre Behind the Mask as part of My Cultura Podcast Network on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you stream podcasts.
In a galaxy far, far away.
No, babe, that's Taken. We're in our own world, remember?
Right. In our own world, we're two space cadets.
And totally normal humans.
Sure, totally normal humans.
Embark on a journey across the stars, discovering the wonders of the universe one episode at a time.
We'll talk about life, love, laughter, and why you should never argue with your co-pilot.
especially when she's always right.
Right. And if we hit turbulence, just blame it on Mercury retrograde.
Or Emily's questionable space piloting skills.
Hey, join us on In Our Own World for cosmic conversations, stellar laughs,
and super corny dad jokes.
Listen to In Our Own World as a part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't worry, we promise to avoid any black holes.
Most of the time.
I'm Dr. Laurie Santos, host of the Happiness Lab podcast. As the U.S. elections approach, it can feel like we're angrier and more divided than ever.
Please stick to policy. Don't get personal.
But in a new, hopeful season of my podcast, I'll share what the science really shows, that we're surprisingly more united than most people think.
We all know something is wrong in our culture, in our politics, and that we need to do better and that we can do better.
With the help of Stanford psychologist Jamil Zaki.
It's really tragic. If cynicism were a pill, it'd be a poison.
We'll see that our fellow humans, even those we disagree with, are more generous than we assume.
My assumption, my feeling, my hunch is that a lot of us are actually looking for a way to disagree and still be in relationships with each other.
All that on the Happiness Lab. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Eddie's trial began in December 1997. Assistant District Attorney Mark Gilson called star witness Billy Wyhee to the stand, along with Joseph Mayo and Melanie Foreman, who repeated what they had told police.
Yeah, he made admissions to me. I saw him with blood on him. I saw him with a pocket full of quarters.
Quarters. It was all over the press when Eddie was first arrested. Police were saying the teenagers had killed Joyce Dennis over a bucket of change from the machines. Then, according to the prosecution, they went to a party, got high, and bragged about what they had done. Eddie's defense attorney was a former DA named Jack McMahon. There was no evidence linking Eddie to the crime for McMahon to refute with experts. The case was all based on alleged witness testimony. So he had to challenge the credibility of each witness. He pointed out that, except for Wyhee, none of them had implicated Eddie in their original statements with police. None.
His strategy was to rely on his abilities to impeach the witnesses based on their own inconsistent testimony.
He was trying to point out that all these kids,
you know, were forced to implicate Eddie.
And these were all teenagers.
Yeah, they're teenagers without their families involved in the interrogation, which is itself problematic. And, you know, it's just threats and threats and threats. And the, you know, if you don't give up Eddie, then you must have done it. You know something that you're not telling us. And it's just, you know, it takes an extraordinary person, especially as a teenager, to resist that kind of pressure.
Or it would take someone who is not in a lot of trouble. Witness Melanie Foreman, for example, was facing two state drug charges and three federal drug charges at the time. McMahon also called Sarah Hurd, the girl who allegedly threw the party where Eddie had confessed. And she testified the party had been the night before the murder, and she never heard Eddie say anything about Joyce Dennis. Eddie's dad also testified that Eddie came home the next day wearing the same clothes he'd been in the day before.
The defense was trying to make a point that Eddie was not seen with blood on him.
Remember, the laundromat was a bloody mess.
It was really inconceivable that a person who would have committed this crime would have, you know, gotten away from there with literally no blood. But they hid the fact that the place was awash in blood.
The prosecution was able to suppress evidence at trial so the defense could not bring up the blood. So the whole case hinged on the word of these witnesses against Eddie. And on January 2nd, 1998, Eddie was convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison.
When I was convicted, I thought to myself, well, I'm arrested, I'm held for trial, and I think to myself, okay, cool. At some point, they're going to realize this is a mistake and they're going to drop the charges and they're going to release me. Like, I was in denial.
What were the first years like?
I was still super young and had no real identity.
But he's had a lot of time to think about what put him in prison and who he could trust.
I stayed to myself. Like, now I wasn't so much isolated as I wanted to learn from my mistakes. And my biggest mistake was associating with people who I didn't have much in common with. Mm. Right? And to this day, I don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so for those first few years, like I'd play cards with you, but we weren't boys.
Years passed and the reality of prison set in.
I remember the date, November 10th, 2006.
Why that date?
That's my birthday. The clock struck midnight and I realized I had just turned 30 and I had spent all of my 20s in prison. And I was like, oh, this is real.
Time passed for Eddie's family as well.
It was just mind-boggling, all the years. The hope was being lost.
But then Eddie was transferred.
I ended up at Graterford, and that changed my life.
Graterford was a maximum security prison and Pennsylvania's largest, able to house about 3,500 men. And Eddie says it was really those men at Graterford who changed him.
Oh, where my family taught me love and tolerance, my brothers at Graterford taught me how to be a man.
Mm.
I met guys like Suave, Tyrone Wirtz, Albert Bandy, Sam Magic Brown. They taught me how to be an adult. And when I say man, I don't mean in no kind of toxic masculinity.
Eddie says these men taught him how to have integrity, honor, and a sense of purpose.
How does that happen in a prison? You know, how do these guys, some of them did do crimes, how do they suddenly just become these like Dalai Lama guru guys?
Because most of the crimes that were committed when they were young men. And they you know, you sit in, you go to prison and you start to see the effect of the crimes you've committed. And then they start to, like, you mature. And so for those guys, I mean, it happens for everyone, but it happens differently, right? And so those guys who are, for all intents and purposes, never going to leave the prison, what do you have? You have your legacy. You have the way that you affect other people going out into the world, and they take that piece of you with them.
And that's kind of what you were thinking, because you were never going to go home.
Oh, no. I knew I was going to go home.
You did.
I mean, listen, there were times where I questioned it, but I would, like, snap myself back to reality, like, yo, prepare. And so from the minute, like, these guys, I met them, and they were like, are you going home? And I'd be like, yeah, I'm going home. All right, well, start preparing right now.
So Eddie got to work. Not only did he complete a paralegal certificate course, but he earned a bachelor's degree. He pushed so that incarcerated students became eligible for the dean's list, and he collaborated as an artist with the mural arts program in Philadelphia. And by his side, the entire time, was his family.
I can tell you that Eddie's family was as steadfast as any I've ever seen. I mean, just the tenacity and the gumption of the family was amazing.
Especially his sisters.
I became his voice out here to let people know, hey, this happened. This is happening. This is happening. People are innocent. And so by me doing it out here, it was motivating him inside prison to better himself, to prepare himself to come out here.
But Eddie wasn't just preparing to get out. He was fighting to get out. In the early 2000s, Eddie filed a series of appeals, one of the main ones being that the prosecution had found DNA under fingernail clippings from Joyce Dennis, and that was never disclosed to the defense. In 2003, testing was done on the samples that excluded Eddie as a contributor, but his conviction was upheld in 2011. Then Michael comes in.
Michael, do you think that his trial was fair?
Well, it can't be a fair trial when evidence is suppressed. That's fundamental to any system of justice. And so the answer is an obvious and resounding no.
In 2015, Eddie filed a petition for relief with the help of Michael Weissman.
So that was when I first met Eddie. And over time, you know, I've come to truly admire him as an individual, as a man, and as a resilient human being.
So,
and he's learned to sort of bear with my sort of like overbearing personality.
If there's anything I've learned from you guys at Greaterford and Philadelphia, you are all big personalities.
We're bosses.
Yes. If there's anything I've learned from meeting all you.
Michael also had the help of the Philadelphia Innocence Project.
When the Innocence Project got involved, the case kind of exploded and, you know, went in all kinds of different directions that I don't know that any of us anticipated at the time.
Not only did they follow up on the DNA motions and suppressed blood evidence, but Eddie's claim for innocence was now bolstered by recantations from key witnesses. Drug dealer Corey Watkins and his girlfriend Melanie Foreman said they'd been pressured to falsely implicate Eddie. Watkins said the police held him for hours until he signed a statement. Foreman said the police threatened to charge her as an accomplice. She was cooperating with the federal government on other cases when she gave her initial statement against Eddie. Remember, she was facing 2 state drug charges and 3 federal gun and drug charges at the time. Joseph Mayo said the police had threatened to charge him with an unrelated stabbing if he didn't implicate Eddie. And Sarah Hurd would later say in an affidavit that the police screamed at her and threatened to take away her baby and to charge her with hiding evidence.
The harassment and the threats against these teenagers to finger Eddie is something that now has a name. It's called the Homicide Hotel. So it's pretty much an established practice back at that time that what the Philadelphia Homicide Unit would do is they would bring in witnesses and they'd basically just hold them for days. So, you know, that combined with the DNA, combined with what we learned to be the suppressed blood evidence was like, you know, just the trifecta of strong exculpatory evidence.
In 2016, additional DNA testing was done on items at the scene, including a broom and the bloody fleece I'd mentioned earlier. Testing found the same male DNA on the fleece as on the presumed murder weapon, the pipe. Eddie was again excluded as a contributor, but the wheels of justice move slow, and the years go by with new motions and delays and setbacks.
I mean, every court appearance, I used to like dread having to go to court because it'd be like, I have nothing I can tell Eddie's mom, who just sits there with tears in her eyes and, you know, waiting for good news.
Then finally, in August of 2023, the state responded to Eddie's petition for relief, agreeing that they had failed to disclose significant exculpatory evidence to Eddie's attorney that would have helped his defense at his original trial.
In a galaxy far, far away.
No, babe, that's Taken. We're in our own world, remember?
Right. In our own world, we're 2 space cadets.
And totally normal humans.
Sure, totally normal humans.
Embark on a journey across the stars, discovering the wonders of the universe one episode at a time.
We'll talk about life, love, laughter, and why you should never argue with your co-pilot.
Especially when she's always right.
Right, and if we hit turbulence, just blame it on Mercury retrograde.
Or Emily's questionable space piloting skills.
Hey, join us on In Our Own World for cosmic conversations, stellar laughs,
and super corny dad jokes.
Listen to In Our Own World as a part of the My Cultura podcast network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't worry, we promise to avoid any black holes.
Most of the time.
When you think of Mexican culture, you think of avocado, mariachi, delicious cuisine, and of course, lucha libre. It doesn't get more Mexican than this. Lucha Libre is known globally because it is much more than just a sport and much more than just entertainment. Lucha Libre is a type of storytelling. It's a dance. It's tradition. It's culture. This is Lucha Libre Behind the Mask, a 12-episode podcast in both English and Spanish about the history and cultural richness of Lucha Libre. And I'm your host, Santos Escobar, the emperor of Lucha Libre and a WWE superstar.
Santos!
Santos!
Join me as we learn more about the history behind this spectacular sport from its inception in the United States to how it became a global symbol of Mexican culture. We learn more about some of the most iconic heroes in the ring. This is Lucha Libre Behind the Mask. Listen to Lucha Libre Behind the Mask as part of My Cultura Podcast Network on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you stream podcasts.
I'm Dr. Laurie Santos, host of the Happiness Lab podcast. As the U.S. elections approach, it can feel like we're angrier and more divided than ever.
Please stick to policy. Don't get personal.
But in a new, hopeful season of my podcast, I'll share what the science really shows, that we're surprisingly more united than most people think.
We all know something is wrong in our culture, in our politics, and that we need to do better and that we can do better.
With the help of Stanford psychologist Jamil Zaki.
It's really tragic. If cynicism were a pill, it'd be a poison.
We'll see that our fellow humans, even those we disagree with, are more generous than we assume.
My assumption, my feeling, my hunch is that a lot of us are actually looking for a way to disagree and still be in relationships with each other.
All that on the Happiness Lab. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
On November 2nd, Judge Scott DiClaudio vacated Eddie's conviction and ordered a new trial.
At that point, I was kind of like, okay, I can breathe a little easier now.
Yeah.
I'm not out the woods yet because I'm still in prison, but...
But the prosecution had 30 days to decide if they wanted to retry him. And they took their time deciding.
I was just like, my brother is going out of his mind in prison.
They're going to get every minute out of me that they can.
Yeah.
I was pissed.
Finally, on November 30th, 20 days after his 47th birthday, Eddie was on his way to court to find out what the state had decided.
The very last minute. The very last minute. We were just like holding our breaths because we have been there, done that so many times.
Eddie was on the prison transport van filled with nerves when there was an announcement.
One of the sheriffs was watching on his phone. And so he yells to the back of the van, "Hey, Ramirez, they just announced it, man. You're going home." Right? And so people in the van are like really happy, like, "Oh, man, congratulations, congratulations." There was this one kid. He was like, "Yo, how long you been down?" I said, "Man, I've probably been down your whole life." And he's 24 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So he was like, "I'm 24. I'm like, "Yeah, man, you weren't even born when I went to prison."
He tells Eddie about the street and gang violence that surrounds him at home. And he says,
"Yo, I just want to be somewhere where I could take my son out and not be afraid of what's going to happen." Mm. And so I said to him, "Well, how important is that?" He said, "It's everything." And so I said, "Well, then everything you do should be about that." And then it dawned on me, yo, God put me on this van to give that one last lesson to somebody on the inside. And so however long the trip was, I stopped thinking about the time because I was like, man, I got an opportunity to do that in that location one last time, because I'm going to, for the rest of my life, I'm going to do whatever I can to be a brother to whoever needs it.
Eddie's entire family, including his parents, were there the day he was released.
And my father, who I had not seen run in 30 years, ran to me. That one's going to be with me for a while.
What's your relationship with him like now?
Oh, man, that's my best friend. That's my best friend. And I'm just so happy. Like, I wonder sometimes if he thought he was going to live to see the day that I would come home. And I'm so happy that he did.
Eddie wasted no time picking up where he left off at 19 years old.
I still skateboard.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, let me not exaggerate the greatness of my skateboarding.
I was going to say, did you skateboard in prison? Because you've only been out a few months.
I have skateboarded since I've been home. And I can tell you that as a 48-year-old, it affects the joints differently.
I'm scared for
you. I am
for
worried about falling. I'm going to break a hip.
Billy Wyhee is the only witness against Eddie who didn't change his story.
and that was Eddie's friend, the one he thought he knew. He took a deal to testify against Eddie and only served 5 years in prison, while Eddie could have spent his life in there. At first, Eddie couldn't help but be resentful towards Billy Wyhee. But today, he looks at things differently.
William Wyhee's a victim.
Yeah.
And I, you know, like, I hate to put it like that because there's a part of me that...
That's the guy that put you in prison.
Yeah. And so there's a part of me that doesn't want to defend him. But how could I not? How could I talk about integrity and character and just throw that guy to the wolves, even though he did that to me? And so I do got to stand up for what's right and say that they took advantage of a kid.
These days, Eddie tries to share the wisdom and perspective he gained from his friends in prison with the new men in his life, his nephews.
You know, he gives them the manly talks. Get up off your butt and do this. And he's always talking criminal reform to them, which in my case, I have a son who, you know, has a little criminal history. So, you know, he tries to teach him what he can do. And all of Eddie's friends are also in that criminal reform stuff. So I feel like that's a really good role model for guys like my sons and his nephews and his niece.
All right, Millie. You're looking good.
And he just lives life.
Hey, Dad. Why don't you tell the world what you're about to do?
Goes to the driving range with his dad and sisters.
Great job, Dad. You look good, man. Smile for me, man. Look at me and smile.
And spends time with his family as much as he can.
You know, everybody's been trying to get a piece of him. He is booked. Solid. We have to literally plan around his schedule.
But there was one date that Eddie couldn't miss.
He got arrested in the middle of the night on the 4th of July. So this 4th of July was the first time that we got to celebrate with him in 27 years. And it was very special for me and my sister that we did something.
Emily wasn't going to let Eddie miss another 4th of July with his family.
I talk a lot about my dad, but my mom, she's super, super faithful. She's a faithful woman, and she had no doubt that he was going to come home one day. And I could tell you that she has bought him things all throughout his prison life. She had racked up items for him for when he came out, household stuff, socks, all kinds of stuff. Not when he came out, of course. Those are like old stuff. He wants new things. So, you know, we have to try to do something with those things. But she is like so happy that she got her son back. And like that is the woman. That woman is. So the 4th of July, she got to see her three children swimming and playing in the pool like we were when we were kids, when we used to go camping. That my dad didn't experience because he came and left. But my mom actually stood around and she saw us playing in the pool. I said, Mom, does this remind you of camping? And she just said, yeah. She had this big smile on her face. She was just so happy that she got to see all her kids, especially her son, playing in the pool. Like little kids splashing each other.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Please support your local innocence organizations and go to the links in the episode description to see how you can help. This episode was written by me, Maggie Freeling, with story editing and mixing by senior producer Rebecca Ibarra. Our producer is Kathleen Fink. Our researcher is Shelby Sorrells. Additional mixing by Josh Allen. Our executive producers are Jason Flom, Jeff Kempler, and Kevin Wordis, with additional production help by Jeff Clyburn and Connor Hall. The music is by three-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Make sure to follow us on all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on all platforms at Maggie Freeling. Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling is a production of Lava for Good podcast in association with Signal Company Number One.
Hey, fam, I'm Simone Boyce.
I'm Danielle Robay.
And we're the hosts of The Bright Side, the podcast from Hello Sunshine that's guaranteed to light up your day.
Check out our recent episode with dancer, actress, and host of Dancing with the Stars, Julianne Hough, revealing the healing journey behind her new novel, Everything We Never Knew.
I am showing up for my younger self, and it is becoming a ripple effect energetically in my life, and that's why I feel so safe now.
Listen to The Bright Side from Hello Sunshine on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jacquees Thomas, the host of a brand new Black Effect original series, Black Lit, the podcast for diving deep into the rich world of Black literature. Black Lit is for the page turners, for those who listen to audiobooks while running errands or at the end of a busy day. From thought-provoking novels to powerful poetry, we'll explore the stories that shape our culture. Listen to Black Lit on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect Podcast Network is sponsored by Diet Coke.
Captain's Log, Stardate 2024. We're floating somewhere in the cosmos, but we've lost our map.
Yeah, because you refuse to ask for directions.
It's Space Jam, there are no roads.
Good point. So, where are we headed?
Into the unknown, of course. Join us on In Our Own World as we uncover hidden truths, navigate the depths of culture, identity, and the human spirit.
With a hint of mischief.
One episode at a time.
Buckle up and listen to In Our Own World on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Trust us, it's out of this world.